Frisco a-roving I went, for to stay in that country, it was my intent. But girls and strong whiskey like other damn...
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is the one, the only, Nick Noble. Retired educator, author, historian, and of course, host of The Folk Revival on WICN for 17 years. Nick, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you, although this is not our first time.
No, I think it's our third.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a third time. But I'm trying to get all the big personalities from WICN on record, and that's what I want to talk.
Understood.
Yeah, and you're one of the big.
I have to lose a little weight. There's no question.
We both can. When did you first come to WICN? Do you remember? And well, like, how did you manage to end up here?
Well, I've been listening to the station. I lived in Southborough for years, and I've listened to the station on and off. Nothing particularly loyal or devout, just listening. And we moved to Worcester in 2007. And for some reason, I started listening more, particularly to the folk show, because I love folk music. And it was Nora, my predecessor, I was aware of through other activities, not through the radio show. She'd been involved with the Rebels in Boston.
What was it? Do you remember her full name?
Nora Dooley.
That's okay. Okay.
And so I called. At one point, I called up and I said, you know, mind if I drop by? I really enjoy your show. And she said, fine. And I dropped by. And then at some point, this is the summer, I think, of 2007, she was doing some folk artist had passed away. Don't remind me who, because I can't remember. And she didn't have much of his music. I said, oh, I got it some music. And I brought it in. And from then on, probably every other week, I would drop by and we'd spend maybe 10 minutes on the air sharing a couple of songs that we liked mutually that I'd brought in. And at one point, she said, I'm going away in a few weeks. Will you sub for me?
Whoa, that's how it starts.
my first comment was, the only radio I've ever done, I did some sports radio in college. Not a lot, mostly color stuff. And I have no idea what I'm doing. She said, well, why don't you do next week's show? And I'll be with you, and I'll take you through, you know, I'll do all the engineering, and I'll show you how it's done. We'll do it together.
Whoa.
So I did that show, and the next week or 2 weeks later, I forget which, she went away, and I subbed. And thank God there's no recording of that show. But
we've all been there, Nick. The trial by fire. Oh, my God.
She said, I have a new job. She lived in the Boston area.
Yeah.
And I have a new job, and, you know, it required me to come in early. I don't want to stay so late here. I'm going to leave the Folk Revival. Will you take over for me? And I said, well, that really is Brian Bartle, the station manager's call, isn't it? So she arranged a time for me to sit down with Brian and talk. And I did, and I took it over on sort of a probationary basis, and I think it was November 2007.
Yeah.
And the probationary didn't last very long, and I've been doing it ever since, almost 17 years now.
Wow. Well, but you just celebrated an anniversary show. How many was it?
About 20 shows back, my 800 show, yep.
Jesus.
I count them. I don't know why. I'm one of these people. There are a lot of people. You've done far more than I have on WICN.
Yeah, but
a lot of hosts, but I count them.
Not all in a row. In other words, it's been different shows.
Right. I've done 800 of Folk Revival. I've also subbed. I subbed on the Soul Show. And I've
Show. Well, you're part of the family.
It's a community, buddy. It is.
Yeah. It really is. The people who have been here a certain amount of time, we're definitely on a different wavelength than the other people.
I mean, to me, it's, and now, of course, in my retirement, I call it my Thursday evening therapy.
That's right.
But it's you know, I spend 3, 4, 5, 6 hours prepping for a 3-hour show.
I know you do. But, well, the one thing that's always impressed me about your show is there's always something going on, and you also have brought in more live guests. No, I meant something going on special rather than, you know, you could just do, let's do folk music and then just like pull stuff out of the folk library.
On occasion, I've shown up and winged it because that's all I could do, yeah.
But you always feel guilty, don't you?
I do. I mean,
the same thing with me in the rock show. It's like,
but yeah, no, I like doing themes. I mean,
well, you also have brought in a lot of live music too.
Well, I really think that originally the concept was, you know, the folk revival. Let's look at the 20th century folk revival period, started about 1950 on.
Yep.
That was the original concept of the show, at least as I understood it. And I love that music, but I also realize there's so many particularly local New England or even Worcester area artists who are carrying on that legacy.
Yeah.
And they need to be celebrated as well. So I bring in folks, and it's sort of half and half. I always play a few of those songs from the old days, but I always try to celebrate what's going on as well contemporarily. Contemporarily is a six-syllable word.
Yeah, but that's what makes the show exciting.
It makes it fun for me. It really gives me – I really enjoy doing that, you know, prepping shows and coming up with ideas.
Yeah, really. Now, the amazing thing, and people may – relatively new listeners to your show may not realize that there was a whole history of folk music on WICN. Ever since I've been here, and I've been here since 71, especially when we were down on when we were down by WPI, there was Gene Pettit was huge. But all I can remember, and this is one of those things where you don't realize it until you're a lot older how cool it was, people like Utah Phillips and all these famous musicians would just come down to the station all the time. And I was like,
they'd show up.
Yeah. They'd just show up. And I'd meet them and I'd talk to them. And then they'd go off and do stuff. And there was just such an amazing history. We were known at that time as a classical music station. A lot of people may not realize that. And then there was folk shows on in the evening. But boy, we were definitely committed to a folk show. And then there was John Henry's Hammer's Coffee House.
It's still there.
And that was amazing. That was a whole – WICN was very intimately connected to that.
And John Henry's Hammer Coffee House still functions.
That's amazing. How long is that? That's got to be
– It's had its interruptions, obviously, but it still functions. I perform there. It's a lot of fun. It's recently, not quite sure exactly when you're broadcasting this or whatever, but recently Randy Sparks, the founder of the New Christian Minstrels, passed away.
Wow.
He was on my show back in 2016. He just came. I was talking with him about some stuff for research. He said, "I'll come by your show." And today when the blossoms all cling to the vine, he showed up, and we had a great time. And I think there are fewer and fewer. When I first started WICN, it labeled itself as New England's Jazz and Folk Station.
Okay, that's really recent. Well, for me, that's relatively recent.
Yeah. New England's Jazz and Folk Station, but now it's Jazz Plus because we do so much other stuff as well, including your interviews, which I love, by the way.
Well, you also do a ton of interviews, too, and you managed – what was the latest interview you just did that we were talking about?
I did with Dr. George Preston Wilson, Jr., who's the current director of the Fisk Jubilee Singers, the oldest – black choral group in the country, the ones who are responsible, really, for introducing the rest of the world to African-American spirituals.
Wow.
I like talking to people and hearing what they have to say about the music.
Do you save all these interviews?
No. I save some of them. I've saved some of them. One of my things is to get a copy of that particular show and edit out the extraneous stuff, dump the underwriting spots and me talking about coming up next to the folk revival and sending it to Fisk University for their archives.
Oh, cool.
So, I do some, I don't save them all. I mean, some of the interviews are pretty basic. Hi, what are you playing? What are you recording? When's your next gig?
Got it. Yeah.
And I like those interviews too, but I like to talk to songwriters about songwriting. I like to talk to people about what they see as their legacy. And that stuff I do save.
What are like some of the most important interviews? Oh, the interviews that really thrilled you.
One of my favorite interviewees of all time is Dar Williams. I've interviewed her five or six times over the course of 17 years, and I love it because I can ask one question and she takes it from there.
I know. Don't you love when guests do that?
I don't have to babble in the middle the way sometimes you have to fill.
Yeah, I know.
And I've had some terrible interviews too where I had to pull teeth.
Oh God, I hate that. We do both.
Are you still recording? Yes.
Right. People don't realize how those seconds stretch when there's nothing being said. It's just horrible. I don't get it often, but when I do, it's always from artists, visual artists, who basically believe their work talks for itself.
And then radio is a visual medium, which I don't quite understand. Yes.
Right, exactly. And then you're sitting there and you just really want to ask them something really basic or something like that. And then I was going to ask you if you had any interviews that just really fell flat.
Well, the worst interview I had, and I will not say who it was, but the worst interview I had was a guy who was in his, he knew this interview had been planned for weeks. He was in his car with the window down, driving
all right.
I didn't want to talk much. So I'd say, so you got a gig coming on Saturday? Yes. and I had to say everything. And he said, yes. You know, is your band going to be with you? No. Oh, so it's a solo piece? Yes.
Oh, God. You really just want to...
I could have done that interview and faked it.
No kidding.
And it would have sounded better because there would have been a car with a window open going 60 miles an hour.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Those are few and far between. A lot of the interviews are terrific. So I love interviewing.
Well, basically, I always feel like that...
But there's so many others.
I know, but for...
Tom Rush is a great interview.
He is.
And he actually showed up for my 400 show. He showed up. It's a great story. My phone rings here about 10 at night. Of course, my wife's first response is, who the hell is calling at this hour, right?
Yeah.
So, and I answer the phone, you know, Nick, I'm filling in for someone in the area, you know, next weekend. They haven't really publicized the show. Can I come on your show and you know, publicize the gig? I said, sure, no problem.
Can you come on my show?
My wife said, who was that? I said, it was Tom Rush. She said, no, it wasn't. Tom comes on my show. I had planned it as a 400th show, just very casual, some local artists who were friends of mine.
Yeah.
And Tom Rush comes on, and his River song was the very first request I ever took as a host back in 2007.
Whoa.
So when I do request shows, I often open with that song. He played it for me live with, you know, just, we had a great time. And
Holy smokes.
Are some people who I've interviewed often, and I really like having them on. A lot of local artists who've been on a lot and are great interviews, especially about songwriting. And then the occasional dud that, you know, I'm not quite sure why they do it or they don't. I love interviewing the folks from the Newport Folk Festival, Jay Sweet and Dan Swain, because they're so supportive of other artists.
Yeah.
And that's what they talk about. They don't talk about themselves. They talk about supporting artists during COVID. They talk about, you know, what they're trying to do with music. And whether you agree with it or not, at least they're willing to articulate that.
What happened to the Newport Jazz Festival during COVID?
I think there was one summer there were no festivals.
Yep.
And then they came back with half the number of people. Because I spent several years running the open mic at the Newport Folk Festival. And I remember the first summer after COVID, I came back and it was like, oh, where is everybody? Although there were still like several thousand people there, but I was used to twice that many.
Huh.
And, you know, they emerged. But what they did is the Newport Festivals Foundation, which is an amazing organization, during COVID, they basically provided grants to artists to survive.
Wow. Wow.
They couldn't get gigs. The only rule they had was that artists had to have played at Newport, but it could have been somebody who played at the open mic.
Wow.
All the rule was is they'll support any artist who had played at Newport. And you have these, everybody knows the big names that show up on the big stage, but there's a lot of folks who show up on the side stages who are, you know, working musicians. And during the pandemic, there weren't a lot of gigs, if any.
Huh.
So the foundation really gave $10,000 grants to some people to survive.
That is amazing. That's incredible.
And they still do. They still support organizations that support artists. I've worked with a couple of groups that support marginalized LGBTQ, artists of color, veterans. They still work with that. They still supply instruments for schools the way we do. So the Festivals Foundation does a really nice job. And very often now we don't talk about the festivals. The festivals sell out. They don't need us to publicize them.
Right.
So I talk about the foundation. I talk about what the good work it's doing. They like that because the average person going to a festival doesn't think about the behind-the-scenes charitable stuff. And
how long have you been going to the Newport?
Well, I've been a couple times earlier in my life, but as WI, representing WICN 2009 through 2023.
We usually have a booth there, don't we?
Yeah, at the Folk Festival we don't anymore, but jazz we do. And jazz we're much more involved with because, of course, we are a jazz station. But I've been representing the station there since 2009. I will not be going this summer. It's very difficult now for me.
Yeah.
But I stay in touch with them, and we still do our interviews, and I still bring on folks from the foundation or musicians who are going to be there, and I talk to them. And as I said, The folk festival sells out in 45 minutes. They really don't need publicity from us. But the, as I said, the foundation does because they're trying to raise money to do good things. So I push that.
It's interesting. Now comes some more personal questions. When was your entry record to folk music? And when in your life? I want you to go back in the way back.
One of three, because my dad and my older brother, he's 10 years older than I, and my uncle all brought these records in.
Okay, that's cool.
One of three, Burl Ives, his children's album, not his Christmas one, his children's one.
I remember that. That was in our house.
My older brother was best friends with Alex Ives, Burl's son. They went to school together.
Wow.
Burl Ives was my very first Santa Claus. When I was about 4 years old, the phone rings about 2 weeks before Christmas, and hello, Dick, this is Santa. What do you want for Christmas?
Whoa.
And what happened was that my brother was over at his buddy Alex's house, and they both convinced Burl Ives to call up my brother's little brother and pretend he was Santa. So Burl Ives was my first Santa Claus. So Burl Ives' children's album, the original Highwaymen, their debut album, My Little Brother Brother Shore, my uncle went to college with them, graduated with them.
Wow.
And pretty much those two. There was a Weavers album that my grandmother and my dad played a lot, but I don't remember much besides Goodnight Irene, and it didn't really kick into my head at that point. But the Burl Ives and the Highwaymen did. Mm. And that was my introduction.
Did you flirt with listening to other kinds of music?
Oh, yeah. Well, my father was a huge Gilbert and Sullivan guy. I was a choir boy at several churches and cathedrals when I was young. What I loved was singing, and my dad really was the guy who taught me harmony because I love harmony. We'd sit stand at the sink, you know, him washing me, drying, or vice versa, and he'd go, okay, here, sing a note, here's the third, here's the fifth, and I'm a sucker for harmony. I sang all kinds of stuff. I sang classical, I sang church music, I sang Gilbert and Sullivan, I sang folk music, Broadway show tunes. My mother loved Broadway shows. My mother also loved Ella Fitzgerald, so I can actually fake most of her American Songbook arrangements that Nelson Riddle did.
Yep.
Because that's how I heard them. Broad, eclectic, lots of music. Love music.
You know, it's funny, and we're near the same age, if not the same age. There was something about that.
You're better looking than I am, though.
You're right. There was something about that time period in the 50s where young people get that sort of broad music education. And those records were in the house. Like we talked about, you know, show tunes. That was the same for my mother, too.
But of course, back then, nowadays, the pop music, what do you call it, the stuff that hits the charts.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, the same seven people over and over again, unless you want to go subgenres, country westerns, but still the same seven or eight people. When we were younger, it was like, you know, they talk about the great folk music scare because all the folk artists had hits in the late 50s, early 60s.
Well, I can remember.
They were competing.
I know. Pete Seeger, Peter Paul, and Mary, the Kingston Trio, the Brothers Four.
They were competing with the Broadway shows and Frank Sinatra and early rock and roll. And it was very eclectic back then. And you don't really get that same, no matter how hard the Grammys try to introduce new categories in terms of popular music. You know, big selling music. You don't get that eclectic thing anymore. You know, you could have in the same week, you could have, an instrumental piece of show tunes. You could have the Highwaymen, Michael Row the Boat Ashore. And you could have How Much Is That Doggy in the Window on the same chart.
Yeah.
And you don't have that anymore.
No. Everything is pigeonholed.
What did who was it? It's in my essay that I wrote. Jesse Norman once said that the only pigeonholes are only interesting to pigeons. the fact is that I'm a huge non-genre guy. To me, everything is everything. So it's music is music. Yes, there's good music and there's bad music. I get that. But there's no good genre or bad genre. There's no need to pigeonhole anything. Look at... You don't get the same thing. Linda Ronstadt used to sing seven or eight different genres in different albums. Joni Mitchell did the same thing. You don't get that now, really.
Yeah.
except the Beyonce just went country, so we'll see.
That was interesting. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My extra special guest star today is Nick Noble, retired educator, author, historian, and host of the Folk Revival on WICN for 17 years.
Now, here's give me a ta-da.
I gave you a ta-da.
Thank you.
Okay, here I'm going to, I know that you've written essays about this. Is there a definition of folk music?
Not one that I'm happy with.
Yeah.
Because it's indefinable, there have been formal academic definitions that all require, you know, it's got to be old, and you can't know who wrote it, and it's got to be eminently singable. And I keep saying, what's old? So if it's if I write it tomorrow and leave my name off it, is 100 years from now it's going to be a folk song? And who decides what the hell is singable?
So wait a minute, was Dylan folk music or not? Like say say Freewheelin' Bob Dylan.
Yes, I believe Dylan still is folk music. The difference is that when he started out, he was imitating the wrong word, echoing earlier folk style.
Right, right.
And now he's got his own style. But you listen to his first couple of albums, and that's why they're so easily covered by other artists, those songs. Peter, Paul, and Mary doing Blowing in the Wind, or, you know,
yeah.
When the Ship Comes In, which is my favorite Dylan song, because it's a rebel song that makes no sense. These are the kinds of things that what people forget is if you take the simplest definition of folk music, it's a music of the people that originates from their culture, their you know, community, whatever. Then, you know, rap and hip-hop are folk music. Jazz is folk music. Now, you can get more sophisticated arrangements that pull it further and further away, but the fact is the bloody Psalms are folk songs originally. They had melody to them.
So wait a minute, but what about indigenous music from other peoples? People usually lump it under the genre world music. Is world music just the folk music of that place?
I would say for the most part, yes. I always equivocate a little bit because my brother-in-law, who's an ex-wine steward, used to say, you know what good music, good wine is? It's wine you like. You know what bad wine is? Wine you don't like.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure that you could argue that any music you don't like doesn't fit, but to define music by what you like or don't like isn't defining folk music or jazz music or rock music. It's just defining your particular taste.
Right.
And which is perfectly reasonable. But I my bad wine is electronica. I can't stand it. Doesn't mean it's
so you're one of those people that when Dylan went electric at the Newport Jazz Festival, folk
that
festival.
That wouldn't have bothered me, actually. That wouldn't have.
Okay.
Is
that story about Pete Seeger with an axe true or not?
He threatened it. He didn't have the axe.
Okay.
He said, I want to, and he later would argue he did it because the sound was so bad. The problem is when we have recordings of that, performance.
Yeah.
Their recording is directly from mic to the tape deck. They're not what the crowd was hearing.
So what was the crowd hearing? Was it just over?
You had our musicians from the Paul Butterfield Blues Band were backing him up, and they were very loud. And he was very loud. And Dylan, in that kind of situation, is often hard to understand.
Yep.
Even though he was doing a song, Maggie's Farm, that everybody knew.
Right.
But his, you know, people complain about Dylan's voice. I always say, you know, you can like it or not like it, but the fact is the man is always on key. That's why people can duet with him. He's never off pitch. He, you know, just the quality of his voice, you can argue about. He's a hell of a musician. And but it was Pete Seeger was saying, you can't hear the words. It's too loud. It's too cacophonous. And he said, I should get an axe and cut those wires. He didn't have the axe. He wasn't wielding it. But it grew up from there. He was not happy with the sound, he said. And there were boos. You could hear a few of them vaguely in the recordings we have, but not a lot because, again, we're getting simply the feed from Dylan's vocal mic to the tape deck. We're not getting his mic to the speakers in the crowd. There's no mic on the crowd.
We're almost out of time, Nick. And I have a feeling we could do this every week. For the benefit of the audience...
Very quickly, Mark, but... folk music is everything. Folk music is the root of all music, and therefore, as Big Bill Brunzi once said, all music is folk music because I ain't ever heard a horse sing a song.
Yet. What about Mr. Ed?
Very good point. Oh, Will.
I have to, for the benefit of the audience, I have to talk about you authored the largest book I have ever covered on Inquiry.
Oh, The Doorstop. The History of
God, Nick. That was so massive. That was impressive. Talk. Uh-huh. You got to give people a heads up about what it was.
It's called The Echo of Their Voices, the 150 years of St. Mark's School in Southport, Massachusetts.
Where are you taught?
In charge of the writing of the history. And they wanted me to continue after previous history. I said, no. You know, I'm going back to the beginning and do the whole bloody thing.
You did.
Yeah.
It's actually
relatively readable, at least in chunks.
Whenever I got that book in hand, I was like, oh, my God.
Does it still hold your garage door open? Is that what its job is now?
No, it's on my shelf. It's like, you know, I read it, and so it almost killed
me. A reinforced shelf, no doubt.
It almost killed me. So what's the pagination of that again? Do you remember?
750 for text. But then there's, you know, indexes and appendices, and so probably close to 800 or 900. But it's also a big, heavy book, and, you know, as I said, it's a hell of a doorstop. It's a twofer. You buy it.
It's amazing. You must be proud, though.
It was. I have not written a book since then. It was so successful.
Well, it was like giving birth to a baby. Literally giving birth to a baby.
As far as I can tell, I think my wife would tell me I have no idea what that's about. But, yes, it was I'm very proud of the accomplishment, no question. And it was the seventh book I'd written, so it's not like I hadn't written a book before.
But you decided to really. Now you don't need to write another book for the rest of your life because this one was mammoth. And by the way, I want to mention small type. We're completely out of time. And again, there's so much more I want to talk to Nick about. Maybe we'll do another interview at some point. My guest tonight has been Nick Noble, retired educator, author, like you would not believe, historian, and host of The Folk Revival right here on WICN for 17 years. It's one of the most entertaining shows. Again, you never know what you're going to find. He'll have guests. He has interviews. And just the music alone is worth the price of admission. Nick, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Mark. I really appreciate it. You take care.
You too. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.
From Liverpool to Frisco, a roving I went for to stay in that country. It was my intent. But girls and strong whiskey.